The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, a wet and windy weekend in Japan with a typhoon passing through. But the J1 Matchday 21 slate certainly did not lack for drama.
No, absolutely not. We had various sports being played in a couple of games. We had goals galore. Just it had pretty much everything this game week. So yeah, really exciting. How are you? Are you still wet?
It was a very, very soggy weekend, no question about that. But things did fine up on the Sunday, and we were able to have my daughter's sports day at her kinder. So, we dried out for that, and that was a nice time. An abbreviated schedule there, but yeah, we got through it, and she had an excellent time. So that was very good to see. We'll talk about Match Day 21, obviously. Before we get to that, though, a little bit about what happened last Wednesday night, Sam. We had the Levain Cup semi-finals, of course, one-legged affairs, and we also had a J1 game played, make up of a game that was postponed earlier on in the season. Agumba Osaka won away at Tosu in that game, and indeed it was an evening for away wins as we had a couple of surprise results in the Levain Cup semis.
Yeah, there were two very, very similar games, actually, where you'd expect Yokohama and Kawasaki to have a lot of the ball and a lot of the pressure, but Kashiwa and Tokyo, both of them defended incredibly well. There were some heroic performances in defence. Kim, I think, for Kashiwa was incredible in goal. I don't know how Yokohama scored, but yeah, and then both teams were able to have enough about them on the break just to cause a few issues, and they both came out winners. So it'd be a very intriguing final, that one. It's not the one anyone expected, I wouldn't have thought, but yeah, it makes something interesting this season. You don't necessarily want, as a neutral, you don't want Kawasaki going and just winning everything. I think this is a more intriguing tie for a neutral.
Yeah, most definitely. So, Tokyo winning 2-0 away at Kawasaki, and Kashiwa 1-0 away at Yokohama F. Marinos. So, these two teams, Kashiwa and FC Tokyo, into the final. Both of them for the third times in their history, and they're both yet to taste defeat on the big stage. Reysol have won this competition twice in 1999 and 2013, and FC Tokyo twice in 2004 and 2009. So the new National Stadium will be the venue for that on the 7th of November. It should be a fascinating game, Sam. As you say, I don't know, it's one of those, whenever Kashiwa are playing, you just expect Michael Olunga to score. So, I don't know, it's pretty lazy armchair analysis to say that if he fires a race, he'll probably win it.
Yeah, well, I mean, just look at his goals. I mean, he's at the heart of everything they have done this season. The one thing that Tokyo, I think they'll have to be getting on to the Kenyan national team manager, because they've got a game 2 days later. So if he's called up for that and Kashiwa can't convince him to stay, I mean, that'd be absolutely vital for Tokyo to get rid of Olunga for that game. So, yeah, if Tokyo fans get lobbying the Kenyan national team manager.
We might have to get the Kai guys onto that, I think. Yeah, they'll have to start change.org petition or something like that to get Olunga selected for the Kenya national team in November. But yeah, it promises to be a fascinating occasion. And we'll move on to Match Day 21 then. And two of the teams we've just mentioned faced off at Ajinomoto Stadium. We mentioned it in last week's podcast. There were a couple of huge games involving teams in the top six on this slate. And with Gumba winning last Wednesday, that saw them move up to fourth in the table, and they travelled to the capital to face FC Tokyo. And we said it was a wet and windy weekend. I mean, the no question, the Ajinomoto Stadium pitch was suffered the most through the torrential rain, basically for 3 days straight. A little bit of football was played. There was an awful lot of synchronized swimming, and a bit of martial arts happening as well. There's several controversial incidents throughout this game.
Yeah, who said the Olympics was cancelled? We got it all here. This, as a neutral, you want to watch. This looked like a really good game on paper, but as a football match, it wasn't very good at all. The pitch was, in dire straits. The drainage, it only seemed to affect Ajinomoto, really. Every other pitch seemed to hold out quite well, but I think this is the third time this season that Tokyo have played pretty much underwater. And I think you've won the previous two against Ceres Negros and Nagoya Grampus, but it wasn't the case here. But yeah, it was so difficult for either team to get anything going, especially in the middle of the pitch. It was just underwater. The ball wasn't moving. But then when you play it over the top, it would just skid over the surface. So it was so difficult for either team to get anything going. It then turned very scrappy. There was, you know, Leandro at the heart of most of the scrappiness, and the game really was decided on a penalty, which is part of these new rules. I don't think anyone likes the rules. The referees have a tough job because they have to go with that rule. So it was a correct decision, but yeah, I think Mita is so unfortunate, and it's just, I hope this rule is rectified sooner rather than later.
Well, yeah, listeners, if you've not seen the incident, occurred basically about 5 minutes before half-time. A set piece, I think it was kind of half-cleared by the Tokyo defence. The ball found its way to Yosuke Idaguchi out on the right. He crossed to the far post. Hirotaka Mita was one of three players that jumped for the ball. Adam Ilson headed it basically onto Mita's raised arm from, 10 centimetres away. Nothing Mita could do about it. I mean, his back was to the ball. He had no idea. It was similar to the Eric Dyer incident, I guess, that Premier League fans will remember from a few weeks ago. Just unfortunately for Tokyo, the referee spotted it. And, he's followed the law to the letter and given the penalty. Adam Ilson winning it with his header and then sending Akihiro Hayashi the wrong way from the penalty spot in the 41st minute. So, we mentioned there was a bit of martial arts happening, Sam, and, unfortunately, I have to say, as an FC Tokyo supporter, Leandro's conduct in this game was, left a lot to be desired, to say the least. Whether he actually punched Yuki Yamamoto in the face in the 69th minute as they chased the ball over the top, I'm not sure. He definitely made contact that he should not have with Yamamoto's face. Leandro was very lucky to stay on the pitch, as it appeared that none of the officials saw it, or none of the linesmen were prepared to mention it to the referee and get Leandro sent off. There was an earlier incident with Kim Yong-Gwon, wasn't there? And then Yong-Gwon, he didn't retaliate. He played the ball, but unfortunately for Leandro was kicked in the face about 10 minutes from time, and Kim was booked for that. But, there wasn't really an awful lot to say from a Tokyo perspective. As you say, Sam, the conditions made the playing of flowing football basically impossible. Tokyo had 50 minutes left in the game to try and equalise once they'd fallen behind, but it just was one of those days.
Yeah, pretty much. The only real chances I can remember for Tokyo were two free kicks where Leandro, I mean, he's scored a lot of free kicks this season and he went close with both of them. But that was pretty much all that was going to get Tokyo back into the game, because it wasn't a day for flowing football or anything like that. So, yeah, it was a game you didn't want to fall behind by, and it was unfortunate that Tokyo did in the fashion that they did. And it was just a difficult one. As for Leandro's kind of martial arts and whatnot, as at time of recording, I don't believe the J-League have mentioned anything in terms of retrospective punishment or not, but I imagine if the referee hasn't seen any of those incidences, I imagine Leandro may be getting a ban coming his way. Then I don't know how much contact is made in all of them, but there's the one there, he flicks the elbow out at Kim, and then he definitely swings a left arm at Yamamoto. So you can't do that. You can't raise your hands. It would have been a red card if the referee had seen it. So I imagine something should come his way. And there was also the incident with Patrick and Umari, where Umari, I think, has lost a couple of teeth, where Patrick, I think he's going up for a corner, but definitely swings an arm at him. I don't know how much that was intentional or just leverage from Patrick, or because he was sort of falling over as well. So I don't necessarily want to say it was a deliberate thing from Patrick, but yeah, it was another occasion where this game got a bit bitty and it got a bit, just not really a football match.
Yes, well, Gumba won't care a jot about all of that, though. A sixth straight win, obviously factoring in the win on Wednesday night as well, has them well and truly flying high in the top four now, on 41 points. So they're just 3 points behind second place Tokyo, having played three games fewer, so they're extremely well placed in the hunt for well, not only an ACL spot, but yeah, an Emperor's Cup semi-final a spot, of course, that goes to the top two at the end of the season. We're obviously a long way away from deciding who will finish second behind Kawasaki, but yeah, Gumba have thrust themselves, if you like, into that mix with yes, this excellent run of six straight wins. So yeah, fair play to them. A good win on the day. They handled the conditions well, and yeah, and more importantly, hung on fairly well after they had taken the lead. The other game involving two teams in the top six at kickoff was fifth place Nagoya hosting third placed Cerezo Osaka. This one was also decided by a 1-0 scoreline, and it was the hosts on this occasion, Nagoya, who claimed all 3 points, Sam, to further tighten things in and around the top six. It was Mateus who slotted home the winner, but I think it's fair to say that Cerezo ultimately paid the price for a bit of sloppiness around their own box. They had given the ball away on a couple of occasions in the last 15 or 20 minutes, trying to play out from the back, and well, yeah, I don't know if it was third time unlucky or fourth time unlucky, but when Bruno Mendes lost the ball out on the right, Grampus finally capitalised on one of their chances.
Yeah, it was weird from Cerezo the way they ended the game, because that's not what you expect for them when it's a tight game like this was. And it was really, it was, as you'd imagine, a Nagoya-Cerezo game. Both teams' defences first, but they've both got good players on a counter-attack, so it only takes a couple of like openings and one of them is going to be taken. But yeah, Cerezo don't usually play it out from the back in the manner that they were doing. And this one, it was Bruno Mendes back there. Striker back defending is never normally great. And he tries to dribble his way out, gets caught. Because the pressure that the Nagoya put on their the opponents when they're trying to play out from the back is a key reason why they've been doing so well this season. And Xavier nicks it off him, and then you give Mateus any sort of space in the penalty area, he's going to score. But yeah, I think Cerezo will be furious with themselves in that. This game didn't really have too much in the way of attacking quality, necessarily. It was defences on top. I think Kakitani got in right quite early on where Langerak saved one-on-one, and I think Kim may have made one save from Kanazaki, but otherwise, as you'd expect with these two teams, defences were keeping things very tight, and 0-0 looked almost a certainty until maybe the last 10 minutes when Cerezo got uncharacteristically sloppy and they paid the price. And yeah, full credit to Nagoya for the way they converted the chance, what kind of won the chance as well. So yeah, another good result for them. They were a team that do seem to drop off every now and then, but they're bouncing back a lot more this season, and it's keeping them right in the hunt for these ACL spots.
Yeah, most definitely, and no surprise to see Mateus bobbing up with the winner, Sam. He's been so important for them this season. We've mentioned him numerous times on the podcast, of course, usually providing for others, but this time, yeah, Gabriel Xavier set him up, and yeah, the Brazilian swept home across Kim Jin-hyun.
Yeah, he's a terrific player, and it's so difficult to defend against him because you never really know where he's going to pop up. He's been left wing, right wing. Here he was more central. He can shoot at the, like, he doesn't need much of a backlift. It doesn't need much time to get a shot away. And yeah, it's just so difficult to defend against it. I think he's been fantastic. I think that loan move to Yokohama really freed him up at the end of last season. He's taken that on this season, has been Nagoya's best player. And I mean, left wing in the league team of the season is going to be a very difficult position to fill. There are about four or five players that have played fantastically, but Mateus is almost at the top of that. I mean, yeah, just so consistent, and yeah, just quality oozes out of him.
Yeah, terrific stuff. So Nagoya stayed fifth in the table. Of course, they were fourth after the last weekend match day, but yeah, Gumba took their fourth spot with their win in Tosu on Wednesday night. One of the other contenders for the left-wing spot in the J1 team of the season, Sam, it might be Kaoru Mitoma, and he played an important part in leaders Kawasaki's 1-0 win at home over Sendai on Saturday. Of course, Kawasaki had been vanquished in the Levain Cup semi-final at the hands of FC Tokyo. That game was just the third time all season that Frontale had failed to score, and it was the first time since their only other league loss of the season away to Nagoya in match day 12 at the end of August. The first half was dominated by chances for Yu Kobayashi. For the most part, Jakub Slovic was up to the task of repelling the former Frontale captain. But finally, 4 minutes from half-time, it was Mitoma who provided the killer assist. He spotted Kobayashi's run and played a lovely through ball, and Yu Kobayashi's first-time shot squirming home under Slovic's outstretched leg, much to the Poles' frustration. Then early in the second half, Kengo Nakamura called a free kick against the bar, and Kobayashi's close-range shot came back off the post as he looked to bag a brace. But, well, Sam, obviously Frontale should have killed the game off by the time the last 15-20 minutes came around, but Sendai were knocking on the door for an equaliser late on, and a few chances went begging. The first major one was to Ballon d'Or favourite Shun Nagasawa.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to him, he caused a lot of problems towards the end of this game. They threw a few crosses into him. He got ahead of his marker for this one header where it hits the post, and then he has another header not too long later, but he heads it straight at Jung. But there were definitely chances there, and Sendai managed to ride the storm, which came for a good 60-65 minutes, where it was pretty much all Kawasaki, mainly all Yu Kobayashi, and he in his one-on-one battle with Slovic and the post. And I mean, really, Kawasaki could have been 4-5-0 up and no one really could have complained, but credit to Sendai, they kept going. There wasn't anything clear cut. Even the Nagasawa one, which hits the post, it's not an easy header for him. He does very well to battle against the defender, get that a little bit of space and get his header towards goal. But yeah, so there were positive signs for Sendai. Still not anything too clear cut, but yeah, you've got to give them credit. To be honest, they hung in. They defended reasonably well. There were quite a few blocks to stop Kawasaki going further in front, and you're going to have to rely on the goalkeeper if you're going to get anything against Kawasaki. And Slovic was back in goal for this game. I thought it was fantastic. Not only the saves from Kobayashi, there was one from Tanaka right at the end of the first half, which he tips past the post. So he had a fantastic game, kept Sendai in it. And yeah, with a bit of luck, Sendai, yeah, if things would have dropped for them towards the end when they were putting in a lot of pressure, they might have got something out of this game. But on the balance of play, I mean, Kawasaki were definitely worthy winners.
Yes, indeed. So a ninth straight league win for the runaway leaders. And, yeah, their advantage at the top is now 15 points with FC Tokyo and Cerezo both losing. And, yeah, well, Frontale, they've got two games in hand on second place to Tokyo. And, yeah, they're 17 points ahead of third place Cerezo, having played the same number of games as them. So, yeah, bouncing back after that disappointment in midweek and, rolling on. And we'll, they do have a weekend appointment with the only team to beat them in the league so far this season. So we'll see what they do to Nagoya to try and exact some revenge. I tell you what, Sam, I'll throw you for a little bit of a loop here in terms of our running order, because we've obviously just covered the three straight 1-0 victories to open the J1 Matchday 21 wrap. So before we get into the goal fests elsewhere, why don't we wrap up the other 1-0 win, and that was down in Tosu. A bit of a rough week for Sagan. Of course, we mentioned a couple of times they lost at home to Gumba on Wednesday night. And then, not quite the ultimate smash and grab, Sam, but Tosu had the better of the second half chances, most definitely, and obviously should have taken the lead from the spot were it not for a spectacular penalty save from Shusaku Nishikawa to deny Daichi Hayashi just past the hour. But, Reds left in joyous scenes after a 93rd minute winner from Akoya Yuruki.
Yeah, it was a get-out-jail-free card, I think. Reds were up against it for a lot of that second half. Not much happened in the first half. I think Sekine hit the crossbar for Reds and then was taken off at half-time, so whatever, that makes sense, I'm sure, to someone. But afterwards, they had their chances. Hayashi did really well to win the penalty in the first place, taking it past Iwakami, and then got dragged down. And then it's a very good save from Nishikawa, but if you're going to be pedantic with one rule and the handball rule, Nishikawa was off his line, so they should have retaken that penalty. Mm. But I don't think anyone wants to see that either. That's another ridiculous rule. But, yeah, very good save for Nishikawa, and I wouldn't be wanting to see that ruled out for just being half a yard off his line or whatever it was. But, really, Reds didn't offer anything. There's some sort of story bubbling under the surface where Leonardo has not played. He's not started the last three games. He was left on the bench in this game. Didn't come off it, even though they were 0-0 with Sagan Tosu. So I don't really know what's going on there, because there's no logical reason for tactically where you would not bring Leonardo on in this situation. So I don't know what's going on there. It wouldn't be the first Brazilian that starts getting phased out by Otsuki. Fabricio left earlier in the season, really didn't get much of a look in under Otsuki, and after he had been very good at Kashima Antlers. So that's interesting. But otherwise, I mean, credits are supposed to Reds in the way they kept going. Martinez has come in for the last couple of games. He's looked quite dangerous. It was another good ball in for Yuruki to score this one, but really it's just another pretty poor Reds performance. But they do seem to get just about enough results to keep them interested towards these ACL spots. But realistically, I can't see them being consistent enough to challenge towards the end of the season.
Yeah, finally back to winning ways after three straight defeats, Reds. But yeah, this has seen them creep back into the top half of the table in ninth. And, Tosu pretty hard done to here. But Nishikawa, a tremendous save, as we mentioned. And as you say, Sam, you've got to give Reds credit for going on right until the end. Kenyu Sugimoto holding the ball up and releasing Martinez down the right. He surged into the box, and Yuruki was in the right place at the right time. Perfectly weighted ball from Martinez, and Yuruki ended up in the back of the net along with the ball, and he was very happy with the result, I'm sure. So, we'll move on. There were goals pretty much all over the shop everywhere else. Plenty of late drama as well that we'll come on to as we work through these games. So we will begin, Sam, with Yokohama F. Marinos and their 4-0 demolition job on Oita. But it did take the defending champions a while to click into gear in terms of obviously getting onto the score sheet. Junior Santos was all action in the first half, and he got the second goal for F. Marinos. That came after Ken Matsubara's spectacular volley in the 55th minute to open the scoring. Matsubara, the right back, it's shades of Kawasaki and Miki Yamane, I suppose, but he's absolutely lasered one into the, not quite the top corner, but he's absolutely belted it, and terrific goal from Matsubara to open F. Marinos' account on the afternoon, Sam.
Yeah, pretty incredible, really. And it's kind of what Marinos needed to kind of get them going. They had all the possession, as they always do, but they didn't really have any cutting edge, especially in the first half. Junior Santos was probably the only one who looked likely to score. That's because they're doing a lot of rotation, as they have to, Yokohama, with the schedule. So there was no Marcos Junior, no Eric was on the bench, no Nakagawa. So you've got those players out, and that really takes away from your attacking quality. But so they needed a little bit of magic to get them going. And Matsubara, it came out of nowhere. I don't think anyone would have had him as first goal scorer in this game. But, yeah, it comes out to him. The technique he shows on his supposed weaker foot to score that goal. It was a terrific goal. I don't think it goes quite in our goal of the season awards. But a goal for right backs, I think it might be right up there. Yeah, terrific finish. And it really set Marinos on their way. Oita got a little bit ragged after going behind, and they defended very well up until that point. But yeah, that goal just kind of changed the game, and Yokohama were very comfortable after that.
Yeah, they basically started doing things in 10-minute intervals, F. Marinos. After Matsubara's goal in the 55th minute, Junior Santos got his just reward for an all-action performance with a brilliant shot into the top corner across Moon Kyung Gun in the 65th minute. As Sam mentioned, Eric started off the bench. He came on, then cut in from the left side of the box and drove home at Moon's near post in the 75th minute, and finished off his brace off the bench by driving in from the left touchline and finishing in a near identical spot to his first at Moon's near post 3 minutes from time. So F. Marinos 4-0 victors. And, it's slightly spotty run for them has been corrected, Sam. They're obviously, we know what they're capable of on their day, and obviously played a lot more games than some of the teams around them, FC Tokyo accepted. But, this was just a reminder, I suppose, if one was needed, of what they're capable of at their not quite free-flowing best, as you say, with not their first-choice 11 available to Ange Postecoglou. But, I guess once that first goal went in, it was Oita were probably holding their noses and wondering how many they were going to get hit for.
Yeah, it just shows that they don't even need to play well for 90 minutes. If they can have a 20, 30-minute spell, they can blow any team away, and that's kind of what they did here. Eric was fantastic, I thought, when he came on. He's been in a rich vein of form back to pretty much where he was last season, so he sort of just added that impetus to it. He just runs at defenders. The two goals he scored, both, as you say, at the near post for the goalkeeper, so you'd probably argue maybe the goalkeeper should have done better, but the way he uses the defenders to kind of block the vision of the goalkeeper, send it the opposite way to the way he's thinking, both perfectly placed to finish it. So it was a really good performance from Marinos. It's difficult, as we've mentioned so often, for them to keep this level of performance up in every game, given they just keep on going. I think they've played every 3 or 4 days since the 15th of August, I think it is, and that's just going to continue as it goes. So, yeah, it's difficult for them. Really interesting game in midweek against Gamba Osaka. That's going to be a real test of how this Yokohama side are standing at the moment, because Gamba are not an easy team to beat. So, yeah, that's one I'm really looking forward to on Wednesday. So, but, yeah, if they play as they did second half here, they could easily blow even Gamba away.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, now, we're going to move on to, some more goal fests here. And, one of the more common cliches in football, Sam, is a game of two halves. So at Hitachi Dai, did we see a game of three thirds between Kashiwa and Kobe? Because, for the first hour, hosts at Reysol, they romped into a 4-0 lead, didn't they? But then came the fight back from Vissel in the last half hour, and they managed to get it back to 4-3. And, on another day, might have even fashioned a remarkable equaliser, I guess, in the shades of Newcastle and Arsenal so many years ago. But, what sort of a game was this, Sam? Because in the 6.5-7 minute DAZN highlights package, obviously with so many goals, I was pretty much only seeing the goals. But apart from an early save from Kim Sung-gyu with Yuta Golke's powerful header, seemingly destined for the net in the 15th minute, a remarkable save from Kim with his foot to keep it at 0-0. But yeah, basically from that point on, it was a Reysol goal after Reysol goal. But we look at the stats at the end of the game, and Vissel have doubled up Kashiwa basically in the shot count. Vissel have lost the game, but outshot their host 17-9. So are these, are these empty calorie shots? Obviously Vissel played a similar sort of game against Yokohama F. Marinos recently, where they were outshot 28-3, but won the game 3-2. Is this a similar kind of thing? Because when you see Reysol of 4-0 up after an hour, you think they've absolutely dominated the game, but is it just simply a matter of they took their chances and Kobe didn't up to that point?
I think that's exactly it, and I think Kim Sung-gyu was in inspired form again. I think, as you mentioned, the one save he made with his foot, he'd already denied Iniesta before then. And Kobe, I think first 20 minutes, they were on top. They had a lot of decent chances. Goalkeeper was on top for most of them. Maybe a bit of poor finishing, but not really. I wouldn't say it was like Yokohama when they played Kobe, where they just weren't getting shots on target and weren't really testing the keeper. I thought Kobe looked quite good, but Kashiwa are just so devastating when they go forward, because they can move from back to front so quickly, and then when you've got the longer on the end of most things, then they're going to score their goals, and they definitely took their chances. But yeah, I wouldn't say it was like Kobe just were not, but pretty useless in front of goal for a while, and then Kashiwa blew them away. I thought Kobe, they've looked a lot better under Miura, and to find themselves 4-0 down was very harsh on them, but you do have to take your chances, and they did start to do that second half. You took the game away from me when you said the Newcastle Arsenal game, because that's exactly what it was. Because they turned it around, where at half time, or just after half-time when Kasha went 4-0 up. It was looking like Miura's like honeymoon in charge has been like he'd had 2 weeks in the Bahamas and then got back to London. It was chucking it down. It looked horrendous for him. But they made a couple of changes. Tanaka came on and they just, yeah, they kicked it up a gear. And I thought they were really hard done to lose 4-3. But and you have to give a lot of credit to the way Kasha would go forward. That Alunga, I think he's on 21 goals now, the two goals he scored. The first is it's a stooping, diving header. He's got a defender all over him. He has to get himself into some awkward angle to score. It's just a really good goal. And him and Cristiano are just, they're a joy to watch. I love them. They were fantastic in that opening game against Sapporo. And then since then, they've just clicked back into gear. And they're going to be tough for any team to deal with. But then, yeah, even so, the other goals, just back to front, just it takes two or three passes to get from one end of the pitch to the other. And Saka is superb as well. He's gone quietly under the radar because of the goals that Alunga has scored, but he was on hand for the second goal and the fourth goal. The fourth goal is fantastic, where he just lets it go across him, arrows it into the bottom corner. So, yeah, Kashua took their chances, but 4-0 at that time was very harsh on Kobe. And I think 4-3 at least shows a little bit more of how even the game was.
Yeah, fair enough. So, a brace of braces for Ray Sol. You've mentioned the scorers, Sam. Michael Alunga in the 20th minute with that stooping header from Cristiano's cross. Ataru Esaka got his first in the 39th minute. Yeah, we thought it was game over a minute before halftime when Alunga tapped in from a yard out after Daya Maekawa's save from Yuta Kamiya's shot looped up and bounced in the 6-yard box. And then, yeah, the pick of the Reysol goals for me was Esaka's second and Reysol's fourth, 7 minutes into the second half. A superb low drive across Maekawa. Junior Tanaka came on in the 58th minute, and then, the turnaround began. 2 minutes later, Tanaka tapped in Daigo Nishi's cross from the right. Then in the 75th minute, he finished calmly from 6 yards after Gotoku Sakai had dug out a cross from the left. And, late drama, Taiyo Koga tripped Douglas in the box, and Andres Iniesta netted from the spot in the 87th minute. And then we had the, funny, remarkable, I don't know what the correct word is for it, Sam, but Shunki Takahashi getting shown a second yellow in stoppage time. Quite an eventful 20-odd minutes for Takahashi. He came off the bench in the 66th minute. He got booked for the first time 6 minutes later, and then shown a second yellow deep into stoppage time, basically for time-wasting. He shaped to go over and take a throw, instead had a drink of water, and strode back onto the pitch. The referee showed him a yellow card, and then had to be reminded about 20 seconds later, after the ball was back into play, that he had previously booked Takahashi. So, he had to stop the game and properly send him off, as he should have done seconds earlier. So that was a little bit farcical. But ultimately, an occasion that all the supporters that were at Hitachi Dai will remember, I reckon, for quite a while. A very eventful game. A game of three-thirds, and the hosts emerged victorious. So they will obviously be wrapped with that. And they stay in the hunt for the ACL spots. It's a very, very bunched up there in the top seven or eight places. Reysol are hanging on there in seventh, as are Kashima in eighth after their stunning late comeback against Yokohama FC at home, Sam. It looked pretty dire for Antlers, especially after they were 2-0 down inside the first 15 minutes. Yuji Senuma leapt to volley home after a deep free kick made it all the way to the back post in just the second minute. And then our man Yusuke Matsuo drove home a superb low strike from the edge of the area in the 13th minute. So I guess Matsuo is probably in the hunt for a spot in the... Is he quite in the hunt for a spot in the team of the season, Sam? It's probably a lot to ask for the young fella.
I mean, if the left-wing berth wasn't so packed with players that are playing very well, I think any other season it'd be a shoo-in. But I think there are probably two or three that are just ahead of him. But take nothing away from how well he's adapted to the league, and he's been absolutely fantastic. We say it every week, and this was just another goal that he scored. He can go off either foot. This one cutting in off his right, on his right. Yeah, perfectly placed through a crowded box to find the bottom corner. I'm not quite sure how he managed to thread the needle, but he did. And yeah, it was just, he's symptomatic of the kind of positive way that Yokohama have taken on this season. I don't know whether that will continue next year when the threat of relegation returns, because you can't necessarily be as open and willing, because they're okay with losing games at the moment, because they're happy just to go forward and attack, and it's brought them several good results. But occasions like this, they will go on and lose the game. But yeah, they're just a breath of fresh air this season, and Matsuo, yeah, has been right up there with players of the season. But yeah, unfortunately, Mateus is there, Mitoma's there, Kiyotake is there. It's quite difficult necessarily for Matsuo to break into that team of the season.
Yeah, fair enough. I thought it was a little bit pie in the sky. But yeah, we obviously, we're big raps for him, and yeah, love giving him a mention. And he's obviously given us a lot of opportunities to do so throughout the season, and especially in recent weeks. Well, Antlers began their fight back. They worked a couple of chances for Juan Alano and Everaldo as they look to get back into the game. But Yokohama FC will be left to wonder what might have happened had Marginho's header gone in rather than hitting the post shortly before half time. Obviously, that would have made it 3-0 at the break, and would have given their hosts Kashima an even bigger hill to climb. But second half, Antlers did turn the screw. It was game on in the 58th minute when Everaldo's crisp first time strike from the edge of the area beat Yuji Rokutan. And then, late pressure, I guess, finally paid when in a frantic finish, Antlers drew level through an own goal in the 88th minute when Rokutan couldn't keep out Masakazu Tashiro's instinctive back header. I don't know if I'm giving him too much credit with that. It basically looked like he planted a header into his own net, and Rokutan did his best to keep it out but was unable to. Ryoto Araki was on hand to fire in if the ball hadn't crossed the line already. And then Araki turned provider in the second minute of stoppage time. A bit of a scramble in the box. Araki was the calm head, though. He pulled the ball back for Kei Koizumi to fire home and win it for Antlers. So, yeah, a heartbreak, I suppose, for Yokohama FC, but another harsh lesson, I guess, on the realities of life in the top flight. We've given them lots of positive mentions in the last few weeks, but the cold hard facts is that they've only won one of their last five games. So they are finding it tough. But, as Sam says, they have been a breath of fresh air and very good to watch for the most part. But, all importantly for Antlers, Sam, they've kept pace with the teams above them. We've mentioned how bunched up it is. And, they had come in on the back of two straight losses, so they couldn't really afford a third here, could they?
Yeah, and I think it goes to show how far they've come this season under Zago, because, yeah, as you say, they'd lost the last two, 2-0 down at half-time, could have been three, easy for them to just kind of phone it in at that point. But they came out second half, completely different team. They were probably worthy of getting back into it. I know the last two goals are a little comical, they're a bit incompetent from Yokohama, a bit unfortunate as well, but the pressure that they put Yokohama under for that second half, they probably did deserve the goal. And it goes back to, you'd expect Kashima of old to always come back in this sort of game, get the late winner, and it's a good sign for them and their supporters that they're starting to do that again. It keeps them in pace for the ACL spots, which if you'd say maybe 7 or 8 games into the season, I don't think anyone would have expected that. So, yeah, credit to the way they've turned it around. They kept going in this one. I feel for Yokohama because it was quite unfortunate the way that they conceded the final two goals. But, yeah, Kashima got back to winning ways, and you wouldn't rule them out a top four finish at least.
So we've got two games left to review from the match day, but before we do that, I'll try and wrap up what's happening in the top half of the table without just droning on and giving you endless streams of numbers, listeners. So basically, you know that Kawasaki are running away with it on 59 points, having played 22 games. FC Tokyo are second on 44 points. And if you're an Urawa supporter who thinks that you're still in the hunt for the ACL places, then fair dues. Reds are in ninth on 33 points, having played two games fewer than Tokyo. But, yeah, obviously it's a huge mess in terms of the number of games that teams have played. But, yeah, so basically 11 points separate Tokyo in second and Reds in ninth, but above Reds, Antlers have 36, and so do Kashiwa. Yokohama F. Marinos have 37 in sixth spot. Grampus have 39, Gunma Osaka 41, and Cerezo 42. And all teams in that range have played between 21 and 24 games. Again, I could read all those off to your listeners, but Google a J League table and you can find out for yourselves. All right, well, yeah, we have two games left to go, Sam, and they didn't lack for drama either. They were contested between teams in the bottom half of the table, but yeah, both had their entertaining moments and some good goals on display, it must be said, at Nihon Daira and at Sibetsu as well. We will begin in Shizuoka with the Shimizu hosting Hiroshima. The visitors made a stunning start when Tsukasa Morishima smashed in a brilliant 30-yard free kick into the top corner. A remarkable shot, Sam. I don't think we have any free kicks in our goal of the season contenders thus far, do we? But this frozen rope from Morishima, that might almost be a top-five contender.
Oh, I think so. He channeled his inner Juninho Pernambucano. It was a fantastic goal. I mean, no one was expecting it. They hardly set up a wall, Shimizu. And Jerry just fires this absolute arrow straight into the top corner. It's one of the better free kicks I've seen watching Japanese football. And just in any football for a while, actually. It was a terrific strike. No goalkeeper in the world, I don't think, would have been able to save it. So, yeah, full credit to Morishima. Terrific goal. And he's got to be in the conversation.
Yeah, it's an absolute stunner. Search that one out, listeners, if you can. So, yeah, a great start to the first half for Sanfrecce. Then Dutra gave Espolz the perfect start to the second half when his shot on the turn squirmed under Takuto Hayashi and crept over the line. This might have been one of the few goals, I think, that owed something to the wet state of the pitch and the ball, because it definitely squirmed under Hayashi. On a normal day, you'd expect him to make that save with his eyes closed. But, an unfortunate one for the veteran Sanfrecce keeper. But, his blushes were spared just 2 minutes later when halftime substitute Leandro Pereira, he had come on for a Douglas Vieira, who himself was a first-half substitute for Ryo Nagai. So, there was plenty happening on the touchline for Hiroshima in the first 50-odd minutes of this game. Leandro Pereira restored Hiroshima's lead in the 51st minute. He lashed in after the Espolz defence failed to clear a Morishima free kick. Hayao Kawabe then made it 3-1 with a neat finish after he was played in by Yuya Asano, another Hiroshima substitute, before Yusuke Goto netted Shimizu's customary late consolation with a brilliant diving header in the 86th minute. Though, Sam, they almost nicked a point in stoppage time. But Goto's speculative shot from 25 yards came back off the bar, and very unfortunate for Espol supporters that Carlinhos wasn't able to sort his feet out as the ball came to him, cannoned off the bar. He wasn't able to set himself before he blazed over.
Yeah, there are a couple of moments like that, even when they had the flurry at the beginning of the second half where Leandro Pereira put Hiroshima back in front. They hit the post then, just from kickoff, when Carlinhos went forward, he hit the post. It's very similar to this, because Dutra then has the rebound and he blazes over. So it was very similar to the Goto one. I think the camera missed it first time around. But yeah, terrific effort from him off the crossbar. And Carlinhos, not sure if he was expecting it, couldn't adjust his feet in time and didn't really get a clean strike away. But it was another really exciting game. Shimizu games always are. It was the typical come back at the end and then probably leave it too late, always have that one chance that they don't take and always lose by the odd goal. But I think, it was a really exciting game. It's not always the case with Hiroshima, but I think they did very well. They rotated their side a lot. They played quite fringe players, which, like, in these schedules, teams are being targeted. Usually Shimizu are one of those where a team will probably put out a weakened team for that one and just think, we can probably beat Shimizu with whoever we put out. And they managed to do that, even with the constant rotation of the strikers. I think the physio might be a bit busy at Hiroshima for this week. But yeah, just on Hiroshima, they only played 20 games. Do you have them still in contention for a top four place, or do you still think they're a little bit far away?
That is an excellent question, and I was going to actually mention, I wondered whether I'd sold them short, the fact that, yeah, that, for example, they played four games fewer than FC Tokyo in second, but trailed them by 13 points. I guess the main reason I didn't mention them when I was wrapping up the top half of the table is that I just think there's too much traffic for them to overcome, basically. I mean, some of their games that they have to make up, they might be against the teams above them, and obviously they would be six-pointers, and they would... It would go a long way towards increasing their chances of finishing in the top four. But when you look at the teams above them, the quality of the teams above them, or what they're capable of, I'm not sure that Hiroshima are convinced enough. I mean, they've won three of their last four. A Hiroshima supporter might be able to make a compelling case to me. If you feel like it and you're a Hiroshima supporter, feel free to do so either on Twitter or in the comments to this episode. But yeah, I don't quite see it myself. I can see the mathematical possibilities, but... well, yeah, I guess in this crazy season, Sam, anything's possible. But I think there's just too many slightly better teams above them that they'd have to climb over.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think, yeah, theoretically it's possible, but I don't think this Hiroshima team is quite as strong as some of the teams where they've been at the top of the table for a while. They've taken a little bit of a drop off this season. They're not quite as like defensively stable as usual. So I just think, yeah, there's a little bit too much for them to do. I know one of their games in hand is against Nagoya, so maybe that could bring them closer. But yeah, to be honest, I've lost track with the rest, so I have no idea who the other game in hand. Probably Tosu, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. But yeah, it's just an absolute minefield, isn't it? All the fixture lists and the games that are going to be made up here, there, and everywhere. Obviously, we've got a full round of J1 fixtures coming up on Wednesday, so no time for anybody to make up any games in hand in that instance. But yeah, so we've got one game left to wrap up the match day 21 slate, and it was a battle of the Kanikos at Atsubetsu Stadium up in Sapporo, when bottom club Shonan Bellmare visited Consadole. The visitors, Shonan, took the lead in the 36th minute with a brilliant curler from 25 yards from Daiki Kaneko. But 6 minutes later, Consadole were back on level terms when their Kaneko, Takuro, redirected Shunta Tanaka's speculative shot past Kosei Tani. Then in first half stoppage time, Akimi Barada headed off the line to deny Anderson Lopez. But 10 minutes after the break, the Sapporo Kaneko finished it neatly past Tani after a run from just inside the Bellmare half. So a much needed, goes without saying, win for Sapporo. Sam, they had really fallen down into the mire, hadn't they? Any win's a good win for them at this stage of the season. The fact that they had to come from behind, that has a little bit more merit to it, I suppose.
Yeah, because and they didn't really start this game well at all. Shonan, surprisingly, were quite good for maybe 30, 35 minutes. I thought Kaneko and Saito really linked up well. Tarik had a few chances at the start. Nakano made one very good save from a header, and then a little bit later, Tarik turned edge of the area and just fired wide. So it was a positive start from Shonan, but after they scored, they kind of lost their way a bit. Saito went off at half-time, and at the second half, really, Shonan offered very little going forward. Sapporo, as always, they look good to a certain extent, and then they haven't usually found the finishing touch, but they managed to hit Kaneko, who's been one who's been more guilty than most in missing chances over the last few weeks. So I was pretty happy for him that he managed to grab his brace here. And a little bit of fortune maybe with the first goal, but he's on hand to turn it away. He's played onside by a guy sitting in the goal after he just made a goal line clearance. But yeah, after that, Sapporo were the better team. Didn't really create anything clear cut. The goal that Kaneko scored, the second one, is really awful from Shonan. He's allowed to run pretty much half the pitch unchallenged. Ono doesn't really get very close when he eventually takes a shot. So it was a deserved victory for Sapporo. It's another really poor game from Shonan, who, I mean, they've probably given up this season. You'd imagine in previous seasons, a Shonan team would always show fight and they'd win games that they weren't expected to, and they'd always like be in the game, but they just kind of wilted second half. It was really poor, and it's a shame because and this might have been the first game since the opening day of the season where there were some away fans in there. I think they got 150 fans were allowed to attend from Shonan, so they had a little pocket there, but yeah, it wouldn't have been a happy journey back to Balmari.
No, not at all. But that's a positive sign. It's great to see that. Yeah, away supporters were allowed in, even just in their small numbers there. So, as you say, a long trip back to the sea.
Not Balmari.
No, to the seaside. Yes, for the Balmari supporters. But they'll have enjoyed their day out, I'm sure. Hopefully, got to the Sapporo beer factory before they made their way back. Down to the Hiratsuka coast. I guess for Sapporo, Sam, obviously, a positive result for a change for them. And basically, they're just left to play spoiler, I suppose, for the rest of the season, aren't they? I mean, for example, on Wednesday they visit Nagoya, and then on Sunday they host Kashima. So their sport for the rest of the season is basically just trying to to stop other teams and they're achieving their targets.
Yeah, and hopefully they can revel in that, because there is a very good side in there somewhere in Sapporo. They've just been on this really horrible run, and they've not really been able to get out of it. They had that one win, I think, against Tosu, and we thought that might have been a kickstarter, and it wasn't. So hopefully for them, this is. But yeah, they just really miss Chanatip in midfield. I mean, there's the creativity and the ability to do something a little bit different, to create a chance out of nothing or to score a goal out of nowhere. It's just really been lacking, especially without the striker there. Bothroyd and missed the last two as well. And Anderson Lopez I don't know if he's not necessarily fit, but he's definitely not as sharp as we have seen him previously. So, yeah, that's lacking. But hopefully Chanatip can get back. Sapporo can get back to the team that has been like another breath of fresh air under Misha Petrovic for the past few years. So they can definitely have a say in the destination of the ACL spots and whatnot in coming games. Because no team will go to Sapporo and think this is an easy game. They'll always think, yeah, we're in for a difficult one here, and Petrovic will continue to attack whatever the scoreline. So they're definitely going to be interesting at the very least.
Most definitely. All right, so that all of the games are rounded up from match day 21. Just as an aside, Sam, is there anything that we need to discuss in detail about Japan's 0-0 draw against the Cameroon at the end of last week, or anything you want to mention before they face the Ivory Coast? I think it's on Tuesday.
Well, to be 100% honest, I haven't watched the game from Friday. It's obviously the day before the J1 game, so that was where my focus was. I saw the scoreline was 0-0, and as yet I haven't gone to really look into it, so I'm really not sure what to say on that. Did you watch the game? Was it better than a 0-0 suggests?
No, it wasn't really. I mean, yeah, it was on. I can't say my full. It had my undivided attention, but from what I can gather, it was a game. It happened, and it's obviously just good to see players out representing Japan again, or for the first time in almost a year. So that's a positive thing, and I presume that Hajime Moriyasu will make a number of changes from the team that started against Cameroon for this game against the Ivory Coast on Tuesday. So, it should be, interesting to watch. Hopefully Japan can get on the score sheet and get a positive result. But, I'm not sure that Moriyasu will be making sweeping conclusions on what he sees in these two games. But, good to get a group of players together and get them training, and we'll see what comes down the line in terms of internationals and whether World Cup qualifiers ever get played or not. But, yeah, I think we can probably move off the national. I just wanted to mention it. I thought it was worth a mention. And neither of us have seen, too much of the game. So we'll move on and talk about, what's coming up in J1 in the next few days. On Wednesday night, as we've mentioned a couple of times, J1 Match Day 22 will be played. And as there is also a full slate of J2 games the same night, John Steele and I will be catching up on Zoom to review the game of the round from each division as selected by our patrons. And speaking of Patreon, have to give a big shout out to Jamie for coming on board in the last couple of weeks. Welcome, Jamie, and great to have you with us. The polls are open, patrons. The four options in our J1 poll, it's open until Wednesday lunchtime, are Kawasaki's trip to Hiroshima, Kashiwa hosting Urawa, Gunma Osaka entertaining Yokohama F Marinos, and Kobe versus Oita. I'm not sure if you've already voted or not, Sam, but there is a very clear early front runner that if you look at even a parting glance at the J1 table, you'll probably know which game is leading this poll. But I don't know if you want to influence our listeners, our patrons, or not with your opinion. But it's a pretty obvious choice, isn't it?
Yeah, it very rarely works if I try and influence anyone on polls anyway. So I imagine Gamba Osaka, and it's the Yokohama is the clear winner. It's definitely the biggest game on the slate, and it's one I'm definitely looking forward to. I think if you chose Kashiwa Urawa, I think that's probably a decent game as well. But yeah, Gamba Yokohama, I think, is the clear winner there in midweek. It's a little more difficult in the J2 poll. There's quite a few kind of intriguing games there. It could go, well, it's not according to the poll at the moment, but yeah. I think it could have gone a couple of ways there. So, but yes, you should have a treat, I think, with Gamba Yokohama in midweek.
Yes, as we record on a Monday night, so still, a good 36 hours before the poll ends, but 11 votes are in, and Gamba versus Yokohama F. Marinos is well and truly in the lead. But 11 votes in, that means we have over 30 patrons still to cast their ballots. So, it still could go either way. And by the way, very cheeky of you, Sam, to say that you're not good at influencing the results of polls. Our earlier J1 goal of the season poll, I beg to differ. But, so those four games are up for choosing for our patrons for Wednesday night's Match Day 22. And then the weekend's Match Day 23 slate is dominated by two clashes of top six teams. In the only game on Saturday, Cerezo Osaka host Yokohama F. Marinos, who are playing the two Osaka sides away in the space of 4 days. And the late game on Sunday is leaders Kawasaki looking to gain revenge for their only league loss of the season when Nagoya visit Todoroki. So, all right, Sam, well, don't want to throw you under the bus here, but Cerezo hosting Yokohama F. Marinos. Cerezo will hopefully not shoot themselves in the foot in the last 5 minutes of that game, but what sort of a chance do you give them, one of the best defences in J1, of holding out the F. Marinos juggernaut, who obviously could be buzzing off a midweek win over Gamba, or might be smarting after being beaten by the black and blue half of Osaka?
I've got to give them every chance. Cerezo plays Shonan at home in midweek, which is, if that's a game you want, if there is ever a game you want, it's probably that one. So they could possibly afford to rest a couple of players, be a lot fresher than Yokohama for this Saturday game. Just not much of a turnaround for either team compared to everyone else. But yeah, you've got to always think Cerezo are in with a chance of getting a result in any game, because they are generally very good defensively. I'm sure Lotina will have got into them the way they conceded against Nagoya, and I'm sure that will be rectified. So they're going to be a very tough team for Yokohama to break down, but as we've seen, Yokohama can on their day break down any team. So it's a very intriguing game. It's fairly similar to how we'd see the games against Kawasaki, and in that last Kawasaki game, it was very even from a bar that burst of 10 minutes or so that Kawasaki really took Cerezo apart. So, yeah, I think you're going to think Cerezo will have a chance with that. I actually think they might squeak a victory in that. I think it might come back to haunt me next week. But at the moment, just because I think Yokohama are going to have to play a very strong team in midweek, I think they'll have to rotate again against Cerezo. I think Cerezo will be the fresher team, and I think they might just take advantage of that.
All right, so what about Nagoya's visit to Kawasaki on Sunday then, Sam? It's the late game. It's the big 7 o'clock kickoff. It's a huge occasion. Grampa's fifth in the table. They could be fourth at kickoff, depending on how results go on Wednesday night. They are the only team to beat Kawasaki in the league this season. So, Frontale will be out for revenge, but Nagoya have shown excellent resiliency, not only on Saturday, but in recent weeks. What sort of a chance do you give them of upsetting the leaders again?
I give them quite a good chance. They've got the blueprint for how to play against Kawasaki. I think Tokyo took that on board last midweek to show that it wasn't just a fluke victory for Nagoya. Other teams can go and do that to Kawasaki. I don't think Frontale are as fluent as they were earlier in the season when they did go to Nagoya and then lost. So, I've got to give Nagoya all the chance in the world. They've got a lot of good players going forward and just very well organised at the back. So it's another clash of styles. If Kawasaki have enough possession, they'll just get that one breakthrough and then it could open the floodgates perhaps. But I think Nagoya, if they play anywhere like they did against Kawasaki in the previous game, then they've got all the chance in the world. But they had to play out of their skins to beat Kawasaki last time, so they might have to do so again here. And I just think Kawasaki are going to have too much. So I don't think they can do it twice, especially away from home. So I'd edge towards Kawasaki, but it's another very tight game. It's an interesting battle of styles.
Yeah, it should be absolutely terrific. On Sunday evening at Todoroki, the leaders, Kawasaki, entertaining Nagoya Grampus. All right, well, I think that's just about it for this week's episode, Sam. A slightly abridged version of J-Talk this week, but yeah, I'm doing double duty, of course, this week with my chat with John to come on Wednesday. So, preserving some of the energy in my batteries for that. We've wrapped up the Match Day 21 slate fairly comprehensively, I would say, and given the listeners something to look forward to for midweek and, the weekend ahead. So, terrific to catch up with you again, mate. And, enjoy the football as the games continue to come chunky and rapid. And, speak to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks again. It's always good to catch up with you. I really look forward to you and John in midweek on Zoom. So, something to look forward to. Should be two good games you get, whichever one you get from J2. So, should be really interesting game, and look forward to speaking to you again next week.
All right, then. Well, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank our patrons for their support on Patreon and, of course, you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up the week in J1. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast. Yes, 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 yes.